From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Molly Melching understands that people are outraged by the practice of female genital cutting. More than 90 million women and girls in Africa and other regions have been ritually cut in this way. But for decades now, Melching has been trying to get people to suppress the outrage and instead use empathy as a way of getting communities to abandon the practice. Melching is a human rights activist based in Senegal, and for nearly 40 years now, she's been fine-tuning an approach that's helping villages throughout the region. It's a process that takes time, that involves listening and respect, and an awareness that a social network is a powerful and widespread thing, and that if you're going to achieve change, she says you've got to plug into it. Melching is in Utah this week, and she's joining us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Throughout Africa, more than 90 million women and girls have undergone the practice known as female genital cutting. And for decades now, the human rights activist Molly Melching has been working to get villages and social networks in the region to abandon the practice. Now, notice I didn't say the word fighting the practice. She doesn't like that word as a way of describing her work. She prefers more expansive, more empathetic language to explain her approach. Empathy is a part of it, so is education. But she's also come to realize that these kinds of efforts have to be holistic. They have to take into account the complicated dynamics of culture and social networks. And she's realized over the years that conversations about values and traditions and families take time to work through. Molly Melching is in Utah this week, and she's giving us an opportunity to discuss all of this with her, what she's learned over the years about responsive listening. We invite you to join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Molly Melching is founder and director of TOSTEN. It's a nonprofit organization on development and social change in Africa. She's the subject, I should also mention, of a biography written by Amy Molloy called However Long the Night, Molly Melching's Journey to Help Millions of African Women and Girls Triumph. And Molly Melching, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me. It's nice to be here.
Well, I wanted to start at the beginning, or back up a couple of years, if you don't mind going with me. You were 24 years old, I guess it was, when you first arrived in Senegal.
That's right.
Is that right?
That's right.
What did you have in mind when you first went? What was the idea when you first decided you were going to go to Africa?
I went to Senegal because, strangely enough, it was the first year that my university, where I was teaching in the grad school, it was the first year they decided to do an exchange program. And they had a student from Senegal who was to go to a University of Illinois, where I was studying and also teaching. And I was to go to Senegal for 6 months. And strangely enough, again, when I arrived, they had decided to call off the program. And I found myself sitting in the airport with no one there to meet me, which was a big surprise. A new culture, totally different than anything I'd ever experienced. And I realized that there was something wrong. And luckily, someone from the American Embassy, it was much easier at that time to get into the American Embassy, helped me out. And we eventually worked it out. They had decided to call off the program, but I convinced them. After having spent a day in Senegal, I said, I'm not going to leave here. I'm going to go in and convince them to make sure this program goes forward. And so the Senegalese student did go to the University of Illinois and taught there in the graduate school program. And he came back. But I was to stay for 6 months, and I've been there now for 40 years.
What was it about that one day? Because I've heard you talk about There was something, I don't even know if you've, I wonder if you can understand what it was about Senegal, if you've been able to really express it, pinpoint what it was about that place that you found so special, because you obviously took to it immediately, once you got out of the airport, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. what can I say? There are places maybe that respond to something deep inside of you and that you feel as if this is a place that you feel very at home in and comfortable in and that you want to remain in. And you love looking around you. Everything that you see is beautiful. And even the way the women were walking in the streets with their boo-boos flowing in the wind and the red sand and the way the people were greeting in the streets, the openness, the kind faces, the warmth that I experienced when people realized that I had a problem, the way they tried to really figure it out, and the way people were very generous with their food. Mm. Immediately, I was invited in to eat at lunch and without knowing anyone. And I just was seduced by the whole country. I said, wow, I would really like to spend time here. And I'm not going to go back. I mean, I fought to get here, really. Yeah. So I really do want to stay, and I'll find a way to stay. And luckily, they went ahead with the program. So I did go ahead and go to the University of Dakar and did the master's program at the University of Dakar, but was not always frequent in the classes because I was out discovering the culture,
yeah.
Going on trips and visiting and going into the villages. I was translating for groups that would come in because I spoke fluent French. But then I also realized I needed to learn Wolof because yeah. Everyone said, oh, people speak French in Senegal. But when I got there, I found that, in fact, most people speak the national languages of Senegal, with the main one spoken being Wolof.
Yeah.
But others also Pular and Mandenka and Serer and Jola, the different languages. And I thought also there were so many things I didn't understand that were so new to me. And I just couldn't get what was going on and why people were saying what they were saying or doing what they were doing or not saying. For an example, people would say, pass me the salt. Or give me this. And I said, they don't say please and thank you. You know, this is very strange. I mean, are they being impolite? Have I done something wrong? And I realized, you know, this is probably not them. This is me.
Yeah.
And I need to make the effort to try to understand what this culture is about, why people react the way they do, why. And when I started learning Wolof, it just worlds opened up to me. I started understanding a new worldview. And understanding why they didn't say please and thank you. In fact, it's actually considered more. You're in more if you just say give me the salt,
yeah.
Or it's the way you ask things in Wolof, and please and thank you are not important words. And there are other things, however, that are very important and that you would absolutely want to do. That would be respectful, and you would have to know that by learning the language. So I actually spent a lot of time learning Wolof, talking to people. I actually went to class for just about a month just to learn the basic greetings and how my world changed.
I wonder if when you come back to the United States, and you travel the world as part of your work, I know, go throughout other parts in Africa, I know, but how has it changed just your sort of social interaction with people? I mean, do you figure in some ways you've taken on the Senegalese cultural, social? I mean, has it become a part of you in that way, do you figure?
I think when I first came back, after having been there 2 years, and it was strange, and I was so full of the experience of having lived in Senegal for 2 years, that when I first came back, I was shocked by the big stores, the Costco's. But at that time, I don't think Costco existed, but there were big stores like that.
Yeah,
I was
yeah.
overwhelmed by all the material things that existed in this country, by the cleanliness. And then I go into the stores and say, hi, how are you? You know, how's your day? And how's your family? And everybody would look at me like, okay, who's this? You know, what's going on? And I realized, okay, I've got to stop doing this because, you know, in Senegal, you go into a store and you say, oh, I'd like to buy some stamps. And they'll say to you, oh, you buy stamps at the place where people learn to greet. You always greet first. You always recognize the person first. Mm. Say their name. You say their family name. You recognize that they come from this family. You ask how their family is. These greetings can go on for 10 minutes. So my just saying, how are you? How's your family? Was nothing. But people responded in a way that was, you know, so shocking to me at first. And then I said, wait a minute, I'm American. I know how things are here. This does not mean that they're not nice people. So come on, Molly, get with it.
Yeah.
You know. And so you do. You learn to switch very quickly. I am an American. I grew up here. You know, I think there are wonderful things about America also. I love my country, but I also love Senegal and feel like it's my country also. There are things that are good. There are things that are not so good. But that's the way it is everywhere. So I try to really emphasize what is the beauty of each culture and enjoy that while I'm here. And then when I go back to Senegal, I do love, I must say, the life in the streets. You know, I always, before I come back to America, I always say, okay, let me go down the streets of life where so much is going on, where people, you know, are out, the men are playing checkers, the kids are jumping and playing their games, and the boys are playing soccer, and the carpenters are working on, and there's just so much life, brimming with life, you know, and you're going, wow, this is so cool.
Yeah.
And that I always say, I'll take that with me,
right?
Until I come back.
When did you first encounter and really become aware of the female genital cutting practice?
The first time was when I was a student. I had a girlfriend at the dormitory where I lived. She was from Mauritania. And she took on me on a wild trip. It was Tabaski, which is the Muslim holiday. And it happened to fall on the same day as Christmas that year. And it was the first year that I'd arrived in Senegal. Mm-hmm. She says, you have to go home with me. And so we went on the train. We got off in a town that borders on Mauritania. And she said, okay, now we've got to go over the bridge. And then we have to get in a truck and go to my village. And I had no idea when she said to go over the river. I didn't realize she meant that we were going to get into a boat. And it was, by the way, it was 11 at night when we had gotten off the train. And it was quite a wild trip. We got to the other side of the river. It was late at night. A family that no one knew, but that said, oh, my goodness, there are no trucks right now. You sleep at our house. Here, you need food. And they brought out bowls of rice and we all ate there. We slept on mattresses on the floor. We were students from the university, medical students. And we went to her village. And we were sitting around one day. I had met the family. I had gone to greet all her friends. And one of the doctors from the University of Dakar came over and said, I'm over here because they're cutting my daughter at my house. And I said, what? And I was shocked because I'd never heard of this practice before. Not at all, really. Not at all. And no, you don't learn about this in school too much.
Right.
It wasn't talked about much at all in Illinois. So I said, what are you talking about? And he said, yes, what they will do is cut the clitoris off. It's a practice that has been carried on for centuries in our ethnic group. And I said, you're a doctor. How could you possibly allow the girl's clitoris to be cut off? And I said, is a doctor doing this? And he said, no, it's a traditional cutter who will do this, and she will use her pen and her knife or her razor blade. And he said, but I cannot stop this even if I wanted to. I'm not for it. I'm not happy with it. But I'd rather they do it while I'm here because girls often hemorrhage because of this. And if there's no doctor around, it can be very serious. And girls have even died of this. And I said, how could you possibly allow for this to happen? And he said, because there is nothing I could do to stop it. And if I told them not to do it, they would still do it. The women would still do it. Because it is something that is so deeply ingrained in our culture that if you don't have it, my daughter would not be accepted. She would be an outcast. She would be considered dirty. She would be called a very horrible name in our culture, in our language. That is just the worst insult you can give to anybody. And it means she would be always a girl and never a real woman. And girls have to go through this in order to be considered real women, respected women, women who can have a respectable husband. If you don't, there are no marriage prospects for you. I said, oh my gosh, this is enormous. This is, I mean, I was just so stunned. I didn't know how to react. It was just very shocking to me. And
what was your initial reaction to it? I mean, obviously you were astounded, outraged, obviously. And this seems like this is the natural impulse for most. You've come to another understanding about it, that it's more complicated than
Absolutely.
Just the idea of outrage.
No, I totally understand how people are outraged when they hear about it. You're outraged by practices that do, again, cut the body in this way, unnecessary practices that we feel are unnecessary because we have no cultural context for this. And especially when it's done on girls.
Yeah.
If it were adults who decided to do something to their body, I mean, we know this happens in the United States. People are doing operations on their genitals and for one reason or another. And, you know, people say, well, that's okay. They're adults. They can decide what they want to do with their bodies. You know, I mean, African women find it very strange that we do breast transformations and facelifts.
Cosmetic surgery.
Why would you do that? That's so shocking. Because people are often are harmed through this. Women have died. Girls have died. Men, too. Because of these botched operations. So they are shocked by that. But this is different, and it's very different. It's
yeah.
young girls, and it is done for reasons that, quite frankly, when you ask people in Africa, which, you know, of course we have, you know, thousands of women that we, when we did our participatory research, and they say it's tradition. They don't
say... So they don't say it's a religious thing.
Well, FGC, female genital cutting, which some people say, and I will address this. I'm sure people are wondering as they listen, why isn't she saying mutilation?
Yeah.
Well, the reason, let me just explain briefly, is
yes.
that we soon found out when we were working in our program that that term is offensive to a lot of the participants with whom we work. Because mutilation, if you look it up in the dictionary, means to cut with the intention of harming of someone. And we always felt and knew that no African woman wants to harm her daughter. If she does this, it's because really she wants her daughter to succeed.
Yeah.
She wants her to be respected. She wants her to have a good life, like every mother in this world. And because she was born into this tradition, she had really no choice.
But wasn't that the central insight that when you realized that it was motivated by, no matter whatever you think about it, that it was motivated by love?
Right.
Wasn't that an important insight
well,
for you in understanding
it? If you look at most cultural practices, I think, you recognize that they were done not to harm. There was a reason. And we have a tendency to forget many of our cultural practices. If you look, that we have abandoned many practices that we once thought were okay, accepted. Nobody said a thing. And so it's there was perhaps a reason at that time. People did not have the information they needed. They did not have any scientific or medical explanations for certain practices. And so, you know, they went ahead and did them. And then when they found out, they went to school, they learned that this practice or that practice was really not good, it was harmful. They said, okay, we need to abandon this. In this case, I think there was a general agreement and consensus within certain ethnic groups, because it's not all ethnic groups in Africa who practice FGC. But those who do, it became a criteria for good marriage. And it was, you know, very, very important criteria, so that there was a reason, but nobody can explain what it was. But it was handed down for centuries. And people just thought perhaps that it was a religious obligation, because often it came with people who were Muslim. And we believe that, you know, it started in 2200 is the first 2200 years ago was the first recorded documentation of cutting in Egypt by the pharaohs, who had many concubines. And so the people really believed it was a control of their sexuality and a fidelity control. And so it was probably with the migrations down through and across West Africa brought to the Mandenka Empire in Mali, which is one of the ethnic groups that is the most that practices the most, really, in Western Africa and Mali. And then as they moved on into Senegal and to Guinea-Bissau, Guinea, you will find the Mandé group, the Malinkés, the Mandenkas, the Bambaras, the Soninkés, the Sarajoles, are the groups that really are very strict about practicing and making sure that every girl is cut. So, and this dates for, you know, hundreds of years back. So one person who doesn't think this is such a good thing to do, imagine that one person standing up and saying, I'm not going to do this anymore. It is very difficult. Now, it has been done. There have been educated people who found out what the consequences were and really have been very bravely confident about stopping this, but they're and they have stopped it with their daughters. I have talked to some of the daughters who were not cut in a country where 94% of the country is cut. And she told me, she said, Molly, my sisters and I were not cut because my father was a doctor and he opposed this. She said, but all of us are divorced. All of us were divorced by our husbands. And I worried about going too far with her and saying, why did they divorce you? She sort of seemed to be saying that when they found out they weren't cut, everyone knows. And so you lose respectability.
This helped me understand it a bit. Professor Jerry Mackey.
Yes.
He has written about the fact that genital cutting, it's a convention that was related to love that a parent had for his or her daughter, their daughter. But he likened it to foot binding.
Right.
And I think it seems to me that Jerry Mackey really helped you understand how this worked in terms of social environments.
Well, quite frankly, this is a funny story. I mean, the person who really taught me about social norms or social conventions, as Jerry used to say, now he says social norms, but it was Dimba Jawara.
Yeah.
And he was a villager. And the first village that stood up and abandoned female genital cutting after they had been through, you have to really understand this, they had been through a whole education program, learning human rights, responsibilities. They learned health information. They learned what the consequences were. And the women, when they found this out, decided to abandon. But the first village abandoned alone. And they got so much grief and flack from everyone else, particularly their relatives. How dare you stand up alone? You know, Africa's very group-oriented. One village, as Dimba always told me, Molly, my village is small, but behind this village are many villages.
It's a big network.
It's a big social network. And if you do not include everyone in the social network with decisions, important, important decisions, you will have, you know, real problems. And he was the one who taught me that. And I said, Dimba, what's the answer?
Yeah.
And he said, well, I'll put on my shoes, I'll put on my sandals, and I'll walk from village to village, which he did. And then Jerry read about this in the Herald Tribune. He was in Oxford. And he read about these villagers coming together and deciding as an extended family that they were going to no longer expect the girls to be cut, that they would no longer practice, that the new social norm would be not to cut their girls. And they did it together as a family. And he wrote me immediately. He was ecstatic. You know, he always says, for the first time in my life, I jumped up for joy and ran down the street and clicking my heels. And I got this incredible letter from him saying, you know, this is how foot binding ended in China so long ago at the end of, you know, the beginning of the 20th century. And it was because
they got together and
it was collective.
It was a collective.
It was making declarations of groups that intermarry, the reference group, if you like, the people who matter.
Yeah.
To you, coming together and saying, I am not going to bind the feet of my daughter. And the others saying, we will not allow our sons to marry a girl who has bound feet. And these declarations grew. They started small, and they grew, and they grew, and they grew, until the practice literally almost ended in 1907. But the first instance of that was in 1895, when someone discovered that there was a whole village of people who had abandoned foot binding because they had done it together. It was a village that intermarried within the, I mean, it was more like a city that intermarried within the city. And so we learned a lot of lessons from Jerry came. He wanted to see, is this same thing, could this happen? Because when you have a social norm in place, that means there are expectations and there are sanctions if you don't do it. And it is considered good by the people who practice. This is when you know the social norm is in place. Then the approach you use has got to be different.
Yeah. It's Molly Melching, founder and director of Toast On. The subject, of course, of the book, However Along the Night. It's written by the biographer Amy Molloy, and she's going to be at the City Library tonight at 6:30, delivering the University of Utah and Sandy Dolowitz in Human Rights Lecture. She'll also be on hand to sign these books immediately after. You can get the details at radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the human rights activist Molly Melching. For decades now, she's been working to get villages and social networks in Africa to abandon the practice of female genital cutting. She's in Utah, and she's going to be speaking tonight. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. She's joining us, though. Toast On. I want to make sure I get that. That's the name of the organization. I've been mispronouncing it.
Right.
I want to get into the principles related to your community empowerment program, the one that you developed, and really get to this issue of that this takes time,
right,
as we said earlier. But when you first began these initial programs, broaching this subject, what was it like? What was that like? How did people take to the idea that you even said anything about this practice?
Right. And you know, it's interesting because now everybody associates me and Toast On with female genital cutting. But really, quite frankly, we did not start at all with female genital cutting. I did this basic education program because I realized people needed information in their own language to make important decisions about health. I saw women who had children with diarrhea, and the children were almost dehydrated, and they needed to be rehydrated, and they would go see the traditional healer. They did not know that this baby needed rehydration salts and that you could easily cure that with this rehydration, and the children would die. And this made me so, so sad. So I said, what people need is information. I started a basic education program. There was nothing on female genital cutting in there until we started work on women's health. And as we were working on women's health, we began realizing we couldn't even give this information on women's health without first doing human rights education. And so as we were looking at things like going to the health hut, women didn't even know they had the right to go to the health hut, that they had the right to ask for information about their health from the doctors. They had no confidence. They didn't know they had the right to speak out, to demand health services in their communities. And they didn't know they had certain responsibilities in regards to their children. Also, all that was discussed. As we were putting together the module, we started questioning, because we heard from the women in the field, that they wanted to discuss this issue. And I was scared to death to broach it. I said, look, I'm an American, a white American. What is my role in this? I mean, who am I to come in?
You don't want to be the Westerner imposing this idea, yeah.
Even though in all of our sessions, we never impose anything. Our whole approach is one of respectful information given in a respectful way, let's say. And this was so important to us. It's not judging people. It's saying you're doing this and this, but these are the consequences, but it's up to you to decide. You're the ones who need to decide this and discuss this. Well, the women kept saying, we want to know more about female genital cutting. And I said, we really can't do this because people will accuse me of imposing my views in the West on others. And I don't want to be seen as someone who's doing that, because we're having so many other results in this education program. People are learning to read and write. They're doing project management. They're running their projects successfully. I don't want to hurt that. And if we're going to then destroy the whole program because people will be so angry. You have to understand that at that time when we introduced this subject into our program, it was taboo to talk about this. It was taboo. People were really, really angry when, if ever, any Westerners particularly brought this issue up. And people were scared of doing it. A lot of international organizations would never broach this subject. So I said, okay, let's do a session and let's talk about the consequences. Let's get all of the health, good health information from the doctors, from people who've had experienced this and had problems with it. We did lots of participatory research. We did sessions that were just very non-judgmental and presented why people do it and said, you do it out of love, but you should know these are the consequences. And we did this. I went to a village and I said, okay, let's test this session. Let's see how this goes. Yeah. So I was sitting there.
Were you nervous?
I was very nervous. I speak Wolof. And I did not do the session. I never do the sessions. I help in writing the sessions, but I never present them in the villages. And there was a Wolof facilitator doing this with a group of women who were originally from Mali who had practiced this for centuries. So she started the sessions, started with a play, started like we normally do. We have plays and songs, and we then ask questions and really engage in dialogue with the women. Yeah. Well, when we went to engage with the dialogue, with a facilitator, her name was Marisol, she never will forget this. The women would not say one word. Now, these are women who'd been through the program and who at first never talked much, but in the end were very, very talkative and would love to discuss these subjects, but they said not one word. And we were all very uncomfortable. And I said to Marie afterward, I said, you know, we're going to have to take this session out. And I went to the women and I said, you all didn't say a word, so we're going to take this session out. They said, Molly, don't take the session out. Leave it in. As soon as you and Marie leave, we will talk, but we will talk among ourselves. Wow. And I learned a lot by that. I realized then that in order to discuss this, people needed to feel like they were among people who really understood. And I could never really understand. And Marie, even being Wolof, could never understand either. And I said, I've made a huge mistake. We need to do this session, but it needs to be done by people who really understand this practice, who have gone through it themselves. And in fact, they are the ones, after the community started to decide to abandon, they are the ones who reach out to their relatives and to their social network to talk to them about the problems associated with this practice. Not Tostan, not me, never me. This is why when people say, oh, Molly, you're out, you know, getting villages to stop. I said, no, 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 it's not me. It's the villagers themselves. They just needed this information. Mm-hmm. They needed basic information, empowering. They needed the human rights, the empowering education. They needed the health information. And they needed help in getting out to the other communities. They're very smart. But they just did not get this in French school. Most of them had not gone to French school. But even if they had, they didn't get human rights education in the French formal schools that they were attending.
Right.
They were getting other types of information that did not necessarily empower them to make these monumental decisions, really, that changed the culture. They've ended child marriage. They've ended domestic violence. All in a very peaceful way, which is what I'm also very happy about, because they put themselves in the men's shoes and gone to them and said, look, you know, we see you beating your wife. She's in our class. She came to class, and we understand that you hit her yesterday. And we've come to tell you that as a class, we've learned about our right to be free from all forms of violence and a responsibility. And we've decided this does not help us achieve our goals in this community of peace and well-being and health. And so we've come to tell you that we have decided we need to stop this. And we know that you do this because you saw your father do it, or you've always seen it, so you thought it's accepted. But we've decided we're going to work with the community, and no one will accept it any longer. And if you do, we will come and talk to you about it. And eventually, if people continue, we will go to the police, because there is a law. This is in our Constitution. We have these rights. We know these rights. And we are going to enforce them now, very peacefully. And the first time that happened, when a group of women went to a man who had beaten his wife, and she came to class, and they were very nervous when they did this,
yeah,
you know. And he said, oh, I'm so sorry. He said, you know, he was felt, you know, bad. They, he said, you're right. I did. My father did beat my wife, my mother. He did beat his wife. And I just thought, that's what you do. That's what men do, to be real men. And they said, no, look, we want health. We want peace. We it's in a, that's part of our language, our culture. We don't want. And he said, here's 5,000 francs, which is $10. He said, put this in your women's group. He said, I'm sorry, and I won't do this again. And that story, I mean, when I heard it, I was totally stunned. This was in the, when we first started these human rights sessions and the health sessions. And but this is a story I've heard over and over and over again, that when women come peacefully and explain that this does not help us as a community to achieve our family values, our goals of living together peacefully, healthily, of, you know, progressing, if you like, and being able to go work and improve our economic status. This does not help us. And we've decided to abandon these practices. The men listen. And you know, this is what's very exciting, is the religious leaders are very much on board. And I really want to say how amazing the Islamic religious leaders have been, because sometimes we get such a negative portrait of Islam in general, but the Islamic leaders in Senegal have backed the movement of the women, and I believe it's because of this respectful approach. They go, they give sermons in the mosque, they go to the baptisms and the marriages, and are talking about how to have peace in your family, you need to abandon these practices. They have been so supportive. And it's amazing because so many people have said, oh, they must be your enemy. I say, no, if you have the right approach, if you understand, again, this is empathy, putting yourself in their shoes, saying they have grown up with different script in a way. I always say it's almost like a different theater where you're given a script, you're reading your script, and you're congratulating yourself, oh, I'm reading my script well. And then somebody comes and says to you, wait a minute, stop reading that script. Here's a new one. You have to be reading this. And they say, wait a minute, who you're in a different theater.
Yeah.
But if you go and say there are alternatives and let's reconsider, because a lot of these practices were decided upon 200 years ago, 1,000 years ago, maybe we could reconsider what script we want for the new goals we have for our community.
I wonder what, we've got about 3 minutes left and I wanted to get to a couple of things here. One of the things is interesting is I wonder, you've got a program like this that takes time. It takes about 3 years really for this sort of engagement program to kind of really work out. And I'm wondering, because you've talked about this before, Is this a problem in getting donors that these programs take a while? I mean, something you seem to have been concerned about.
Oh, absolutely. People want quick fixes. They say, oh, you in FGC. Okay, go in for 2 weeks or go in for 2 hours even. And yeah. Or even, oh, you can do this in a year. And they forget that these are not isolated subjects, that they're very interconnected and interdependent. The health of women, economic status of a community, all of this needs to be addressed. The human rights, the education level, and that takes time. And we're not just in there to because we want people to abandon FGC. Why are we working? We're working to help people to achieve their own goals for development. That's how we start with the visioning of where you want to be. And it has to come from within, because if it doesn't, it will not be sustainable. But if you want sustainable development, if you don't want them to fall back or to stop or just be working on one isolated issue, which never works, quite frankly, then you need a holistic, comprehensive approach. You need that time when women discuss and think about it and go back home and have a day to adopt another learner, which is what we do, and then spread the word and then reach out to their families. And all that takes time and patience and perseverance, which is, I think, the key to all of this, that it does take time. And I think 3 years actually is a short amount of time. Really? But for donors, they like 1 year. They often say, what? More than 1 year? Oh, dear. You know, and that is difficult. It is difficult.
Yeah.
But when you think of the money we spend on bombs and drones and war, and when you think about what basic education and national languages can do for whole communities and their whole social network, you realize this is really a very inexpensive way of achieving peace within the continent of Africa, but not just there. Quite frankly, even in America, I think these approaches will work. In Asia, in many other countries where people have come and said, we need a program like this. Unfortunately, we don't have the funding. All the funding is going to bombing other countries. I just feel very strongly about this. Human rights education, empowering education, comprehensive in one's own language is so key to sustainable development from within.
Let me ask you this finally. You travel throughout Africa and throughout the world, but you've often said that when you return to Senegal that you feel like you've gone home. Is that home then? From now, and are you sticking around? I mean, you figured you'd stay maybe 6 months, and now you've stayed 40 years.
40
now, I think
years,
it is.
Yeah. No, that is my home. I have my daughter there, and I have Tostan. Even though I am at an age where I'm thinking about transition, because I want this organization to last. I don't want it to depend upon me, and so we're really putting in place the means to ensure that this organization continues with the work that we're doing. Our hope is to reach thousands of communities across Africa, and that will take time. And I will always be a supporter of Tostan and do what I can to raise the funds we need to reach out. We have new programs. We have a very exciting new program on early childhood development that's just having amazing results.
I wish we had more time for that because I'm utterly fascinated
by that. Oh, it's incredibly fascinating. What we did is use the social norms approach, what we learned from ending FGC, and we're seeing that there are social norms that actually hinder brain development and that could really help children. But because of these deeply entrenched social norms, parents are not talking to their babies and
interacting. They're not bonding in the right way, I guess. Or...
Well, it's because, and there are reasons because of this,
of course.
And so you need to do another whole nother
show.
I will.
I shouldn't even have brought it up, but I'm so glad.
But we're doing other programs like peace and security and teaching women to mediate and go to the conflict table and be really involved in creating peace within communities and at the regional level, cross-border. I think... you know, I have a lot left to do.
So, you sound like it.
So
you're very engaged.
As long as they need me, I'll be there.
Good. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for your interest.
It's Molly Melching, founder and director of Tostan. It's subject, of course, of the book However Along the Night. It's written by the biographer Amy Molloy, and she's going to be at the City Library tonight at 6:30, delivering the University of Utah and Sandy Dolowitz in Human Rights Lecture. She'll also be on hand to sign these books immediately after. You can get the details at radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.